Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Bet online, the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your sports action. The tournament is coming, and so is the $100,000 Bracket Madness Contest, as BetOnline is the spot to be for all your bracketology needs. BetOnline has you covered for all the news, scores, and odds. It's the best way to place your bets, and it's free to sign up. So head to the website betonline.ag or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, your online sportsbook experts.
And you're eating your soup.
Welcome back, everybody, to episode 2, season 3 of the Soccer Soup. We have a very special guest, Grant Wall, aka Alan Gordon's lover, I guess you could say. I mean, he mentioned that you were his favorite player from the MLS, so that's a really cool thing to have.
That's common to me, but yeah, there's just another guy coming on. Big fan, happy to have him, happy to talk to
and
him.
Yeah, and he was actually, yeah, so he said he was wearing your shorts for the interview, so let's see, we'll have to get it checked out, see if he's living up to it.
Also common, another man wearing my shorts.
This is a normal occurrence for you, Gordo?
I give out my shorts.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's bring him on. Welcome, Grant. How you doing? How you doing, Grant?
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. Thanks for being on, man. Appreciate it.
Ah, thanks for having me. Good to see some friendly faces. It's been a while.
It's good, my man.
You guys probably had less clothes on the last time you guys were in a room together, right?
Hey!
Hey!
You still have those shorts of mine, Grant?
I was going to reveal these a little bit later.
Yeah!
Our official Alan Gordon Chicago Fire shorts.
I like that.
Dude, that is top quality right there, Mr. Yeah. Grant Wall. You come straight from a workout, or do you wear those around just on any given Monday?
I do wear them as workout gear. I collect soccer shorts, uniform shorts for my workouts. I feel like as a grown man, I probably shouldn't wear like shirts, jerseys.
Yeah.
But shorts are great. You know, they're great for workouts. They're not too long like basketball shorts. They're not too short like running shorts.
I do the same thing. I just do men's underwear. it gets a little weird. I've gotten a few, you know, but it's about as far as I go.
Gordo was very inspired by T.O. back in the day and hasn't let it go since. Practical too. Oh my God. What do you do with your phone? Soccer shorts, notoriously no pockets.
What's that?
Soccer shorts, no pockets. What do you do with your phone?
I tend to wear a hoodie. At least like, you know, before the workout,
but they got the built-in liners, so you can just put them in your package.
I mean,
that'd be a lot of,
I'm looking down my shorts right now. I got liners on these. I don't have liners on all of them.
Okay.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah. Fair enough, man. Well, listen, Grant, we appreciate you jumping on, dude. I know that, you're kind of, you're running through a lot of podcasts these days. You got the yours going on as well, right? How's that going?
Yeah, it's good. You know, so just had Santiago Solari on today, who's managing Club America, used to manage Real Madrid, went to like D3 college here in
Dirk and Jersey. Talking about
yeah,
Dirk.
I remember. Didn't he play at Real Madrid as well, or is that completely off?
He won the Champions League. Yeah, that's what I remember. Yeah, played all 90 minutes. He was part of the build up to Zidane's ridiculous goal in the 0-2 Champions League final, where he volleyed it out of vertical drop out of midair.
That's crazy. I remember hearing, I think Sasha Kleshin told me that. There was a guy from that played at, you know, Division III New Jersey. I was like, what? Like, how we never heard of this guy?
Yeah, that's wild. Funny.
Yeah. No, man. Like, there's so many great interviews out there in the soccer world. So, like, that's what I've been doing. It's just been fun to, like, have people on.
Yeah. How often are you recording?
So, I come out Mondays and Thursdays. And... you know, that keeps me pretty busy, but I'm also writing stories still. I have a current agreement with Sports Illustrated for 2 more magazine stories by the end of next month. I had one come out today on Ronaldo Phenomeno.
Yeah.
Legend. OG.
And you know, like, weird stuff happened with Sports Illustrated and their new operators about a year ago, but like, if anyone wants to find out like why, like, I got let go, you can Google news stories. Google the one in the Washington Post if you want the most accurate one.
Are you not privy to get into that?
I literally can't get into it at this point due to constraints, but
physical constraints, right? Like handcuffs, shackles, armed bodyguards standing.
Now we're getting somewhere. I knew we could break it down.
You know, like, it's like, I care deeply about Sports Illustrated and everything about the history of the magazine and my history with it. And so, early on after I got let go and it had nothing to do with the quality of my work, it was clear to me that I needed to, like, my public persona needed to be connected to continuing to do good work. However possible. And so I started a podcast, Football with Grant Wall, in mid-May of last year, twice a week. We've done 90 episodes. And what I realized is I could get, even without the backing of some big publication, I built enough relationships over 2 decades. I could get Jurgen Klopp to spend 20 minutes with me for an interview. I could get Jason Sudeikis to come on. And I think what we're seeing in media, and I'm curious to hear what your guys' thoughts are too, like, but what we're seeing in media over the pandemic, everything got accelerated, all the sort of issues with the media and lack of advertising going down and lack of support to do quality work got accelerated during the pandemic. And so, all, you know, it's now direct to consumer is this big thing. And if you have an audience, and I have an audience of over 800,000 Twitter followers, maybe I can reach those people on my own without the help of some publication and start to build something and have ownership and equity. And so that part's been pretty interesting. And so it's really important moving forward for me to own the intellectual property on my feature stories.
Yeah.
So wherever I work moving forward, and there's some real nice options coming up, like, it's crazy because, like, I've been grinding at soccer for 25 years, you know, since MLS started. And I remember when media wasn't really interested in our sport. And so now I'm sort of tickled to see where we've gotten to and to see that, like, you know, big streaming companies like Apple and Netflix and Amazon have a huge interest in great soccer stories and turning those from written stories or podcast stories into video documentaries and being willing to pay for the rights to those things. And suddenly our little sport is getting valued more because those companies see they're global companies, right? Yeah. And they see the potential for income on that. And it's really changed the landscape for anyone who tells soccer stories in a really positive way.
All right. Well, so then you're not going to divulge your seven-figure deal with Apple yet, which is fair. But how about let's start at the beginning. Let's start with Princeton and Bob Bradley and Jesse Marsh. Unless there's a beginning prior to that we need to know about. Were you Jesse Marsh's roommate, or how did that all happen?
Grant, I actually have a story. I don't know how it came up, but when Jesse was my coach at Red Bull, I remember him talking and I think he had, you know, early days kind of not introduce you to soccer, but kind of helped you a little bit, like get into it. Is that right? Was it your first time kind of covering that sport and you didn't know much as far as, you know, the tactics and that?
I mean,
is that like a brag from Jesse?
I actually don't know how it came up. I don't remember how it came up.
Okay.
It is a little bit of one, but it's not that far from the truth. Okay. So I got to Princeton. I'm from Kansas City. I grew up lower middle class on the Kansas side and got this wonderful financial aid package to go to Princeton. And
I was looking for the same one. It didn't come through.
And it was funny because I wanted to cover sports for the school paper. I'd started to get into soccer, I guess, in the early 80s as a kid in Kansas City, like when the NASL had died. I was big into indoor soccer, which I was a Kansas City Comets fan. And Kemper Arena would be sold out. I would go to games.
Mm-hmm.
And got into it there. I didn't get into outdoor soccer until probably the 90 World Cup.
And were you a player?
I mean, I played to like age 15, you know, like so many other kids, and then quit
positions, and so we can categorize you.
I mean, I had good vision.
Can we guess?
for my age? Yeah, like feel free.
Dan, go. You're up first.
The 15th man on the roster.
I was 15 years old, so at least I played. But like,
I would say like an outside mid.
Left mid was my first guess.
Central mid could actually see a little bit, you know. Okay. But like, I was a better basketball player. I was a better cross country and track and field runner, and so that's what I chose in high school.
Okay.
Got into the 90 World Cup big. That was my first big outdoor thing that I got into. U.S. is playing in the World Cup for the first time in 40 years. Yep. Watched all those games. Really got into it. I remember we couldn't afford cable television, so we watched Spanish language. And I still tell Andres Cantor that he was a huge reason that I got into soccer, because he broadcast every game of the 1990 World Cup in Spanish. And I watched him.
Yeah.
Crazy. 2 years later, get to Princeton as a freshman, joined the school paper. They assigned me to cover the men's soccer team, coached by Bob Bradley. Jesse Marsh plays for it. And I covered that team and then picked up things. And I always tell Bob Bradley, like, I've been asking you stupid questions since 1992, you know, like, and Bob is an intense dude, but I love Bob. He treated me like I was a professional journalist when I was a student journalist.
Yeah.
And actually answered those stupid questions. And I remember in 93, he took a team to the Final Four and lost to Bruce Arena's Virginia with Claudio Reyna. And they had a complicated relationship, Bob and Bruce, because Bob used to be Bruce's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
This was before they coached together on the 96 Olympic team.
It's kind of funny how everyone's just relate. Like, everyone just kind of...
small world.
Yeah. Like, and I mean, and Grant, you going to Princeton and happened to be covering Bob Bradley, who became obviously a top soccer American coach. It's pretty crazy.
It's pretty wild. Yeah. And Jesse and I became friends because we both ended up in the University Health Center at the same time, sharing a room. I got like food poisoning or something. And Jesse had some malady of some sort. I don't know what it was. And And we spent a couple days in that room together and like, you know, kind of like got to know each other better than maybe we had before with just me covering the team. So
Grant, do you think that is there like a an unwritten rule that if, you know, between bald guys, you know, like, do you think that had anything to do with him answering your questions and being, you know, and that relationship really building?
Did you, and you Bob have hair at the time?
Are you assuming I was bald at 18? By the way? I mean, like, when people actually see pictures of me with hair at that age, it's surprising.
I kind of was imagining you with a bald head at 18.
If you want, I can send. I'll send you a picture from like, you know, my senior high school picture that has a full head of hair on it.
That's great. I love it. Looking at this.
But you know, I mean, like Bob was awesome, and he and I remember the first magazine story I ever wrote was for the Princeton Alumni Magazine on Bob when they got to the Final Four, and you know, I mean, he helped me with a scholarship that I was applying for, like,
that's cool.
And yeah, none of us knew we would still be dealing with each other so many years later. And so we sort of laugh about that now.
Yeah. That's pretty crazy. Very cool. That is wild.
Clear conversation than was going on at the, were they dinner clubs or, what were those? What are the frats called at Princeton?
Eating clubs. They were essentially co-ed fraternity sorority type places, right, where you would eat your meals. I mean, I met my wife in my eating club. I ended up doing
you
pretty
remember
well.
I had a bunch of buddies that ended up at Princeton. And they always talked about this. It was like, I don't know. It didn't compute. Like, what is an eating club? But it's one of those things that you do at an Ivy League school that lasts like 560 years and it's around forever.
That's over.
Dan was the kid that got left behind.
Yeah. Left behind. Yeah.
He didn't make it.
One more time than
it's over Alan and I's head, like way past those.
I'm just learning about Princeton now. Yeah. This is amazing.
It was a really respectable high school, Gordo.
And now a word from our sponsor. Hey guys, want to give you a brief moment to talk about our newest sponsor, eBay. Whether rare, dead stock, or the latest release, find the exact shoe you're looking for. As the original sneaker marketplace, eBay is the place to go to cop the pair you've been eyeing. With eBay's authenticity guarantee, your sneakers are meticulously inspected by independent professional authenticators. A team of experienced sneaker authenticators verify the box, the logo, the stitching, and dozens of other inspection points. Each sneaker also receives an authenticity guarantee tag that includes a digital stamp of authenticity, and it also protects sellers with a verified return process. And for the sneaker sellers out there, eBay has eliminated selling fees on sneakers 100 and up, making it free to sell and flip your collection. So go to ebay.com/sneakers today. eBay, the world's destination for discovering great value and unique selection.
Hey, Nino here. Here's something you didn't know about me. I don't relax well. With my crazy life, it's hard for me to shut off my brain and chill. I overthink. I get easily stressed out and it effing sucks. So I did my homework and found Sunday Scaries, which are delicious vitamin-boosted CBD gummies. They've been a must-have in my daily routine, and they chill me out in just about 20 minutes. Basically, they help me take the edge off so I can maintain my composure and live scare-free. And there's no risk to buy. The company offers 100% lifetime money-back guarantee. If the product's not good for you, that's okay. You get your money back. Sunday Scaries, in the stress-relieving business, not the stress-causing business. And guess what? I got you 25% off to prove it. Visit SundayScaries.com and use the promo code SOUP for your discount. That's promo code SOUP for 25% off at SundayScaries.com. They're effing amazing and you won't regret it.
Grant, we also read earlier, which I had no idea, but it was cool to see that you, I guess, considered a bid for the FIFA presidency at the time.
I didn't consider it. I declared.
Oh, so you fully planned. I thought I read that you couldn't, or you didn't declare once you didn't receive like sanctioning from a governing body or something, which ultimately changed FIFA's rule. Like, give us a little background on that.
Ooh, let's go. Was this Kyle Martino? Was he in the running or before?
This was before.
This is
right?
way this is before Kyle Sunil. Martino. I was a little before my time, I think. So the big day that sort of caused me to do this was the day in December of 2010 when FIFA gave the World Cup hosting rights to Russia for 2018 and to Qatar for 2022 over the US. And I was there in Zurich. It was my birthday, December 2nd, 2010. And the idea that Qatar would host the World Cup, despite all of the massive issues with migrant workers and heat for players and all of those things, it was pretty wild. And so there were huge questions coming out of that about FIFA not being a clean organization.
Right.
And so I remember asking a buddy of mine, Gabriel Marcotti, who works for ESPN now, and he was sort of an expert in these areas. And I was sort of like, is it possible for anyone to run for FIFA president? Because there was a FIFA presidential election coming in 2011, right after that. And Sepp Blatter had been the FIFA president for forever, and nobody ever ran against him. And so it's not like I thought I would win, but I thought I could make an interesting statement by
platform, right?
Declaring that I was going to run for FIFA president against Sepp Blatter, and here's why I'd be a better FIFA president than Sepp Blatter. And we had some fun with it. You know, like what I learned was that anyone could run for FIFA president. All you needed was one nomination from one federation from around the world to be in the actual election. And we made a campaign video, which you can still find.
What was your campaign slogan? Give us your presidential campaign slogan.
Oh man, I think, yeah, it's out there. It's out there. It's pretty good, actually. I was like shaking hands with people on the streets of Manhattan here in New York City. And like, I was saying, like, I'm running for FIFA president, and people would like look at me and go like, good luck.
Clearly, dub the audio over that one, because New Yorkers are really like, what the hell is this guy?
And no, and some people are like, I want no part of this, but like, it was fun. And I think my slogan was cure the bladder infection.
Straight political.
It was actually a really interesting experience, because like I was probably 15% serious about it and like 85% not. Uh-huh. But there was this whole history of satire in the U.S. Like the great writer Norman Mailer ran for mayor of New York City in like the late 60s and actually got a lot of votes. Mm-hmm. But like they were like, he was making a point about,
yeah, why isn't anybody else running? Like, we can do things better. Yeah.
And so I feel like I was a little ahead of my time, because that was 2011. And all of the FIFA arrests from the U.S. government happened 4 years later in 2015. And that's when things really went down. And I ended up not being able to convince a federation to nominate me. It was funny, because I met with like these very serious people from the Iceland Federation, and Sunil Gulati in the US wouldn't nominate me. And this guy from Italy said they would nominate me, but it was a public nomination and they would get negative blowback if that happened. So
can I ask you why the US didn't? Like, what was Sunil's reason?
The general feeling was that because it was a public nomination, that they knew I wouldn't win and they knew that they would get negative blowback from FIFA. Whereas the actual vote, if someone had nominated me, was a secret private vote. And so I was told by Italy, like, if you can get someone to nominate you, you'll get votes.
Okay.
But no one had the courage to nominate me. So I ended up writing this 5,000 word story about the whole experience. Cause like FIFA like sent out these like goons to try and like become my friend and like learn stuff about me and find out if I was serious about it. And it was all sort of cloak and dagger. I met a guy in France, like on a park bench in Paris on the Champs-Élysées. And like, I wrote about it. It was kind of ludicrous.
Jeez. That sounds wild.
Yeah. Car tailing you.
Worthy of 5,000 words for sure. So, All right. Well, then this is moving from FIFA to U.S. soccer. I want to see. Give me your best Taylor Twellman. Your best. What are we doing? I want to see that. I want to see where you're at with U.S. soccer right now. You've been covering it a long time.
I mean, I had a good rant last night on my podcast because we recorded it 10 minutes after the U.S. lost to Honduras. Oof. And failed to make the Olympics for the third straight time. Yeah. I can keep things in perspective, right? I mean, like, I realize that qualifying for the World Cup is by far the biggest thing for U.S. soccer this year. And they're going to have to play 14 World Cup qualifiers from September, very soon from now, over five windows until March. That said, failing to qualify out of CONCACAF again, and we've seen this happen now for three Olympics and one Senior World Cup, it's just not excusable. And I can step outside our soccer community and understand how big the Olympics is to the American sports fan and absolutely, how big of a missed opportunity it is. Can you imagine, like, if I don't think all of the best U.S. under 23 players would have been able to get releases for the actual Olympic tournament, but I think several of them could have, and they all wanted to play for a reason because they know how big the Olympics are in the U.S. And so the wider public has viewed U.S. men's soccer over several years now as a group that can't qualify for tournaments. And that continued again last night. And it's a real missed opportunity to not qualify for these Olympics because they would have been given a lot of attention given the players who would have been there, given the fact it's the Olympics. So I'm really bummed out. And I wonder, I understand all of the reasons why the best U23 players couldn't be on this team, but other countries were dealing with the same thing. And Mexico and Honduras have qualified.
Grant, when you watch soccer, are you like, how do you break down the game? You've been around a long time. Are you an X's and O's guy? Are you a tactical genius? Or do you take on another approach to, everybody sees soccer in a different way. How do you watch it? And why do you think that we're having so many of these issues?
I mean, it's interesting. Like, first and foremost, I'm a storyteller. Like, yeah. That's what I'm best at. And I understand that. And also I realize, like, I never played at a high level. I never coached at a high level, but it's funny because I've seen a lot of soccer over the last 25, 30 years. And so I do feel qualified to analyze a game and what's happened in the same way that a good restaurant critic can write a review of a restaurant without having been a master chef. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Do you get the most pushback because you didn't play at a high level and people don't respect your knowledge of the game?
I mean, it's just interesting over time what you run into. So like, I have a good relationship with Greg Berhalter, for example. And I've covered Greg for a long time, but I still remember a question he asked me when I did a story on him as the Columbus Crew coach right before the final against Portland in 2015, I think.
Yeah.
And he asked me, do you consider yourself a soccer expert? And that's a fair question. There's a little bit behind that, though. and I get it. I mean, look, I'm paid to have opinions about what happens on the field. And not everyone's going to agree with that if you have opinions.
Was that a question to a question?
Yeah, I was wondering.
Did you answer the question and you responded with that?
I don't even remember the context. It's a good question. I don't know exactly where that was coming from, but it's fine because, like, I think by this point, Greg and I have a pretty open back and forth, and I'm cool with that. And it's not like this was going in my story that I was going to write. Just he asked the question.
Right. What was your answer?
I said basically the same thing I just said to you, which is I haven't played or coached at a high level, a professional level, and yet I've watched this game for 30 years. I feel like I can analyze what's happened in a game. And I ran into a little bit in television. So I was with Fox Sports from 2012 to 2019. And my feeling is there's a, like, I certainly don't compare myself to Skip Bayless and don't want to, but like one of the trends over the last 20 years is writers with opinions becoming some of the most valuable commodities in sports television, right? And so PTI started all of that. Mm-hmm. And so I was surprised that at Fox, I had to fight a little bit. Like there were times when I was told like I could not have an opinion on television.
And was that, is that more of a Fox position or was that more of a Grant Wall, we don't want to hear your opinion?
That's a good question. In terms of like, not your
opinion, but Grant Wall, we don't want to hear your opinion on the tactical setup of this match. We want to hear from whoever it is that was, you know, the tactical expert.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say is my sense was that was a particular producer or two at Fox. Mm. And overall, I really enjoyed most of my Fox experience. And for the most part, what I ended up doing was insider reporting, video essays during major tournaments. And then during the World Cup in 2018, they actually did let me go on the nightly show and have opinions. And I thought I added to the discussion, because I don't think you need to have played at some crazy high level to have an intelligent opinion on the game.
Yeah. Let's reference one of your opinions that we're talking about right now in terms of the Olympic qualifying. You tweeted today, strange to call Olympic qualifying a youth tournament when these are all professional athletes at this point. So let's talk about that a little bit. Talk to me, walk me through what the opinion is there.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's been kind of weird to me to see some of the excuses that have come up for the U.S. not qualifying for the Olympics again. And if I'm being honest, like, do I think that this failure to qualify is an indictment of where the U.S. under 23 players are in terms of development? No, it's probably not, because you see a lot of them playing in Europe now. But I still feel like I saw too many people saying qualifiers that come off as excuses about not qualifying again. Three straight times is a disaster. It's a total fiasco, a debacle.
Yeah.
Whatever word you want to choose.
Right.
And so part of that was seeing people calling this a youth tournament. It's an under 23 tournament, but soccer is different from other sports. So many of these guys, all of these guys are pros now. Guys turn pro often when they're 16 or 17 around the world, including in the US now. And so 23, there were literally guys on the field last night who were 24 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That's not young.
That's soccer. A prime in Europe.
Man. Yeah, I'll tell you, I was thinking about this tweet, and I don't know how you feel, Gordo or Sal, but I feel like looking back on my career as a 22, 23-year-old, I was a baby deer in the professional game around men, and I was not a part of the men's game. I was there, and I was physically present, but I definitely felt like a little kid an awful lot coming straight out of college, and I kind of would push back on the youth tournament and say that I still feel like it is a youth tournament being U23, whether you're playing at Chelsea like Pulisic is, or whether you're whoever, any one of the kids that was there last night and being, you know, in a US B squad. I still think that you have so much to grow into, and the fact that they keep it at that cap, that U23 cap, I do feel like it's a youth tournament. I think that that's fair representation.
I disagree with that 100%. I'm more with you, Grant. It's not a youth tournament.
It's not.
Well, I have a question though. Like, would you have considered it a youth tournament maybe 20 years ago when there's guys still in college, you know?
If there's guys in college playing in the U23s, I can remember covering. Yeah.
Okay, so the
qualifying tournament for the 2000 Olympic team, those guys are all college.
The idea of it being youth As soon as you turn a pro, you are no longer a youth. Is that what you're saying?
No, no. I mean,
these guys are 20, over 21. U17, when I saw Sal playing the U17 World Cup, that's a youth tournament.
Okay.
U20. Yeah, that's U20, but yeah.
The U20s U20. And U17.
You look like you were 17.
You're closer to U23. But, you know, thank you, Sal.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree with you 100%, Dan. You and I were different because we went to college. You can only play 3 months out of the year, sanctioned, you know, and we drank in chased girls the rest of the night, which was a really good life. I mean, I feel bad for these other kids, but yeah, I mean, we turned pro. We hadn't even started to play soccer yet. We had to learn quickly, and we were terrible because of it. Okay. You know, these kids are, you know, these kids have been playing serious soccer for a long time at this point. I mean, going through the academy and then going straight into they're pros.
But you're calling them kids. You're calling them kids, and I think that that's my point is they are kids. Whether you're a pro or not, you still have so much development left. I agree with you. I did not play 1/10 of the amount of soccer that these kids that were playing last night have played in a high level environment. 100%.
Okay, but let me ask you a question. When you watch a Champions League game, okay, uh-huh. Let's say it's a final, and you see you name. There's
how many 22-year-olds are on the field in the Champions League final?
Right. There's been some, right?
There
has there not?
Have been some. Yeah, there have
there's,
been
there's
some.
There's probably been a lot.
There's probably been a lot. Final, yeah.
But in Champions League, there's been a lot of players, right?
There have been a lot of players that have played in a Champions League game, absolutely. But not
a lot.
There's not 11 versus 11 that are 22 years old.
No, but do you say, oh, he made a bad pass, but that's okay. He's just a kid.
Yeah, you do.
You're letting him play with the big
boys. No, you do. Yes,
you're letting
you do.
Him play with the big boys today, but, you know, it's okay. No, you don't.
Yes, you do. What are you talking about? That's a common thing that gets uttered by people like myself. Like, oh, yeah, you know what? He's a rookie. Or, yeah, you know what? He's a young player in the game. It's still – you're still young. You could play 100 matches by the time you're 23. I think Stevie – how many games had Stevie played by the time he was 23? Who knows? It was a lot. But he would still be considered a young player in the game. He's still maybe not boots,
not
but he's
a
still a young player.
No. I'm totally fine calling the U20s a youth tournament, the U17s a youth tournament, U23s with 24-year-olds on the field last night. Not really.
Still have borrowed older players as well?
Well, for the Olympics.
Yeah,
itself.
For the actual Olympics. Yeah.
I mean, give me the specs. Give me the specs on the kid that scored the game-winning goal for Honduras. Didn't he play for like some like second-rate community college, followed up by somewhere else that was nondescript, nothing, and then is now like looking for a team that scored, right?
You know more about that guy than I do, but I do. But like he like took advantage of a pretty wild situation on the deciding goal. I feel terrible for Ochoa, by the way. Like, I mean, I think he was terrific against Costa Rica in the opener. I think he's one of the younger players on this U.S. team. I think he has a good future, and I hope he recovers from this in the same way that Sean Johnson recovered from his mistake as a goalkeeper in the 2012 group.
Yeah.
And I think he can. But, like, it's still all professionals and things have changed since you guys were emerging yourselves. And so we need to approach them as professionals in this case.
I think we can definitely all agree that it's definitely more now not a youth tournament than it was when we were playing. I mean, there were still guys getting called up even in my time to a few U23 camps and they were still in college. And myself was one of them right before I, you know, left UCLA. So, and with Bob being the coach before Peter Novak took over. But yeah, I went through the qualifying process. And at that stage, you know, definitely we were young. But even then, I think everyone that was on the actual team were professionals, at least a few years at the professional level. So yeah, I'd say pre our time, you know, you could pretty much label it a youth tournament. But nowadays, with some of these guys turning pro at such an early age, it's tough. It's a tough thing to say.
It's funny, though, because I can go back to the first story I ever reported for Sports Illustrated in 96 at the NCAA Final Four. And I remember writing about, you know, MLS was in its first year and they were doing this Project 40 thing they were introducing. And it was all about bringing young players into the professional ranks and skipping college because college soccer was viewed as this bad thing for professional development. And they were still going to pay for their college education. But this is a story that's been going back for decades about how should we view college soccer. And it's still incredible to me, like guys like Clint Dempsey spent several years in college soccer in a way that Landon Donovan never did. And Clint Dempsey was still able to sort of make up for lost time and make the most, the absolute most of his career.
I think you guys are viewing this through a US-centric viewpoint. And everybody else in the world hasn't changed a thing. We're the only ones that have changed. We're the only ones that are doing something different from the time that you guys are talking about to now. So I think that, you know, I agree with what you're saying, but in certain aspects, but that progression has jumped for the entire player pool in US. I think the vets are better, the mid-level guys are better, and the youth are certainly better, but they're still, I still see them as youth. I still see them as young in the game.
We're better, but we're not qualifying. I don't get it.
This is the Olympics. I mean, your whole life, did you think of the Olympics as a youth tournament of sports?
No, but no. Soccer's the only one that caps it at U23.
No, hockey did it too. Did we think the Miracle on Ice? Did we say, oh, they're just kids? And they bit, you know, like
yeah,
great movie.
They sent a bunch of college kids. That was the tagline.
Great movie. If you haven't seen it, great movie.
Maybe go watch it again, Gordo. It's a bunch of
kids. Hey, there's 12-year-olds doing gymnastics that can do better, more stuff, you know. Like, come on. It's the Olympics,
pal. All right, whatever. I think you're wrong, but you usually are. So anyway, Grant, tough position to take with Gordo agreeing with you. We wanted to hear about LeBron James, and we wanted to hear about how he ended up in your rental car, where you were going, how his parents signed off on this, and how many friends did he have with him in tow?
Okay. February 2002, I think. I was still covering college basketball for Sports Illustrated. I did soccer on the side at that point. You know, the previous summer, the big high school story was this guy, LeBron James, had this amazing ABCD camp in Jersey and became the number one ranked prospect in the country. But like in the country, and he wasn't even a senior, like he was a junior.
Right.
And so I said to the college basketball editor, Greg Kelly, I said, I think maybe I should go to Akron, Ohio and do a story on this guy, like a feature story. And got the approval, parachuted into Akron, Ohio. And somehow, maybe I was younger then, convinced LeBron and his buddies to let me drive them to an NBA game that night that they were going to go to anyway in Cleveland, an hour away, that involved the Cavs against Michael Jordan's Washington Wizards. And so they eventually agreed to let me do that. I drove them up in my rental car. We stopped at McDonald's, the drive-through on the way. It was LeBron, Maverick Carter, who's also now probably like a billionaire as well. A couple of their other friends. And I still don't know how I got into the arena that night because they had tickets left for them and I sort of snuck in, but was there to see Jordan hit a buzzer beater to win. LeBron was like rooting for Jordan, not the Cavs. And afterward, Jordan gets brought out to talk to LeBron. And I end up sort of lurking and documenting that conversation as the lead for this magazine story because at that point, Jordan was working on behalf of Nike to try and sign LeBron for Nike. And at the time, it was like, I remember writing it was going to be like, oh, it's going to be like a $20 million shoe deal. Ended up being $87 million that he signed with for Nike. And we put him on the cover, LeBron. During the middle of the Winter Olympics that was happening in the U.S. in 2002, it was sort of a bold decision.
Who cares? Don't put kids on the cover. It's,
you know, actually, I worried about that stuff, right? Because I didn't know he was going to be on the cover. It's a part of me was like, anytime a writer gets a cover story, you're fist pumping, right? But like,
I feel like I kind of remember other, this. Was he in his Irish uniform with a green headband?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Michael Lebrecht shot the photograph. It's an amazing photograph. And so half of me was kind of like, are we ruining this kid's life by putting him on the cover? Because the cover of SI was an even bigger deal then than it is now. It was a different stage of the internet, and people really hadn't heard of LeBron James around the country. So
was there a ton of similarities with, obviously you covered Freddie Du, you did the podcast segment. Was there a lot to that? Was Freddie's hype you felt more or less, or what did you think?
I mean, I did my first Freddie story 1 year after the LeBron story. So it was still fresh in my mind. And I still feel like by then I knew that LeBron was going to make it. And so we had taken a risk putting LeBron on the cover, and it had paid off. And it looks great now, but like nobody knew LeBron was going to make it like that. Yeah. And then Freddie didn't. And
conversely, at the time, Freddie was an adult, right? That was the conventional.
That is the difference. He's like Benjamin Button. He's been aging the other way.
Oh, I mean, all I can say about that is that first story, we literally hired someone in Ghana to go to the place where Freddie's birth certificate was filed, and it was what he said it was. I don't think that's 100% proof that he's the age he said he was, but we couldn't find any evidence saying he wasn't.
I just I always found that wild that was part of Freddie's story. It was part of his start, was that like there's no possible way he could be 14. And that was like, that was the narrative around him, which is nuts.
I mean, the big difference between Freddie and LeBron was that LeBron was older and Freddie was younger. And so it was easier. Like, I think it was easier for LeBron to go from that point to like succeeding in the NBA than it was. Like, Freddie had a lot farther to go. And we saw that. And I guess I still am surprised in retrospect that Freddie didn't succeed more. And that's kind of what I got into in my podcast series.
Yeah.
Did you play with Freddie, Sal?
Yeah, I played with him in the U20, his third U20s, but my first U20s only, when he kind of broke out a little bit against Poland and a few other games. And then he parlayed that into his big move to Benfica.
That was a good team.
That was a good team, yeah. Looking back, I mean, you know, you had myself, Robbie Rogers, Michael Bradley, Josie, Chris Seitz, obviously a lot of guys that ended up having, you know, solid, good careers. So,
yeah,
it was a good time.
That year, 2007, was when I started hanging out with Alan Gordon's LA Galaxy a lot.
Yeah, so who's the bigger star, LeBron or Beckham?
I mean, if you look at globally, these are the two global sports, right? So soccer and basketball. I mean, I'm pretty lucky to have done like extended one-on-one interviews with LeBron, Beckham, and Messi. I mean, like, that's been
incredible.
And Gordo. Has Gordo ever thanked you?
I was going to say.
Has he ever thanked you for changing his life or what? Has sent you anything other than a pair of Chicago Fire shorts or where are we at?
You've always said I was one of your better interviews. I mean,
I am actually not joking here. Yes. I don't want to start crying here or anything, but like, I just want to say that when I started my book project about Beckham's LA Galaxy, and I had done a cover story on Beckham coming, and I had interviewed Allen and other LA players, including Landman. It was clear that there were some people who would be very interesting to follow and continue interviewing over Beckham's first couple years. And Alan was certainly one of them. In fact, right near the top, and he delivered, you know? I mean, he's literally, I mean, like, my favorite character in that book, my favorite MLS player ever. I'm not kidding.
That's great.
Who knew this was going to turn out to be a Gordo tribute concert? I appreciate that. Wow.
I appreciate that. That was a wild time. It's fun to look back at that.
What was your favorite time, Gordo, when Grant was around? Like, you were living in a different world, obviously, than a lot of your teammates. And I mean, my years at the time were in Colorado, nothing like the star-studded Los Angeles Galaxy. What's something that stuck out to you that Grant probably didn't put in his book?
Well, can we put it in a podcast?
Yeah, I don't know if we can put that in a podcast.
You know, these are stories that you tell at the bar. But, you know, it was wild. It was like, you know, there's probably five guys that you could count on your hand, you know, over the span of time that could really draw. It's like the Beatles, Michael Jackson, Michael Jordan, LeBron, and Beckham, you know, and like probably Messi. You know, it's like, it's that kind of group, you know. And just to see, like, we would be outside of New York, the Giants Stadium, one of our first games, and there was literally like 50,000 Beckham jerseys.
Yeah.
It's like, where did you get these jerseys? And it, like, they were all there just to see him. And that was kind of the most amazing thing. We played in front of so many people, and we were really very insignificant in the whole deal, you know. And there was just, it was glaring what a big discrepancy there was between players at that time, you know, MLS, American MLS players, and, you know, these guys that they wanted to come over to build the league.
What was it that stuck out to you, Grant, about Gordo? As a guy that's in a 30 player locker room.
Don't say my nose.
I mean, what I loved was that here's Alan and other guys, but who are being asked to start games in front of 60, 70,000 people and perform. And everyone's watching domestically and globally because David Beckham's on the field. And you guys aren't getting paid anything. And
don't remind like, him, don't.
And how absurd that was to put those expectations on you for that little amount of money. And just how crazy that was. You know, you literally had a guy in Beckham who I've always thought is a good dude. I know you think so too, Alan. Like, but he was making what, $50 million a year, including endorsements, and playing on the field with guys making $20,000, $30,000 a year. And that created some crazy disparities, obviously, on the field, in the locker room, when everyone would go out to dinner. And like, to Beckham's credit, he would go out to dinner with people. And what I loved about Alan was that, like, it seemed like none of that mattered to you. Like, you were just going to interact with Beckham and everyone else on a human level. But not many guys could sort of do that.
Yeah, I could see that. So,
but that team was interesting, I remember, because there were some good talkers on that team, which is all I was looking for. Like, you know, Kyle Martino was on that team, and Kyle obviously was a good talker. And I remember talking to him. Pete Bionis was on that team, good talker. I also remember trying to like build inroads with guys like Abel Xavier, and
he wasn't having it.
And he was not having it. So one of my favorite stories from that whole stretch was when we were at RFK Stadium in the locker room after one of the early games with Beckham and the team. And
I think we lost 4-0.
And Abel takes me into the bathroom, like the restroom in the locker room, and starts screaming at me. Like, and Abel's like a unique dude, right? Like yeah. Beard like and yeah. Hair, Dennis Rodman, all like, all white. Yeah. You know, he had like a white Bentley that he drove around LA. Like, he played in literally like every country in the world. And had played at a high level, so he had respect. And he kept yelling at me like, this is not correct. This is not correct. This is not correct. And like, he was upset that I was writing a book in which I was, I guess, not giving a cut to everybody. That was my sense. It was like an unauthorized book, which is not how we, you know, in the US, we don't pay people to do interviews and write a book. Maybe in other countries, like where Abel had been. And so I always remember that like interaction in the bathroom. And eventually Abel didn't work out well with Ruud Gullit, the coach. And I remember when Ruud got fired, that Alan was telling me stories about how like Ruud Gullit would like tell him that like watching TV, like games on TV, like you need to be more like Paul Scholes and stuff like that.
He did. The team found that very, very amusing because he said it in front of the whole team. Alan, it was a preseason game versus Houston. We were in Hawaii and one of our midfielders got hurt and he put me in and I'm playing against like the trialist from college, you know, and I had a really good like 10 minute stint in the midfield and he thought he had discovered the new Paul Scholes. So he tells me in the airport, he's like, Alan, and Man United's playing some serious game. We're all watching. He's like, this is what I want you to do. And I'm like, Scholes? And he's like, yes, Scholes. And the team's just like, yeah, that was pretty good.
You didn't have that in your bag, Scholes, Paul Scholes?
Ruud told me, he told me a lot of funny things. He took me into his office once and he said, Alan, I like you. And not many people do, because Alexi Lawless was trying to trade me at the time. He's like, a lot of people do, but I like you. And I was like,
I'll take that.
Okay, yeah. Sweet, cool. All right, see you out in the field.
Thanks, coach.
Yeah.
The funny thing about it is, like in the book, I quoted, you know, everyone, and sort of like it was one of those things. There's a phenomenon when a coach gets fired right afterward. People are willing to tell all the stories about how bad the coach was that they weren't willing to tell before. This always happens.
Understandable,
it's a media
though.
Phenomenon.
Understandable.
And everyone feels liberated and it's great. And like, we're free. We can actually talk about what it was really like. And so that was part of the stories that I was hearing. And so I ended up telling those in the book. And Ruud doesn't come off that great in the book just based on those stories. And I remember at World Cup 2018, Ruud and I sat next to each other for about 2 hours. And the whole time I was thinking to myself, does this guy know that I wrote the book? I wasn't going to bring it up to him.
That's great. Cool.
Yeah, he probably would have roasted you. You guys weren't sharing beers together, apparently.
He's a good dude. I just think he didn't really put much effort into coaching the LA Galaxy.
Fair statement.
Yeah. Fair enough. Grant, we'll talk. So we'll let you go pretty soon. But before we do, I'm gonna ask you one more question, and then we're going to get into Alan's interrogation room. He'll ask you five questions. But I just had you covered college basketball. Who do you got for this tournament, you know, as we're in the Elite Eight now?
I mean, I am probably a little biased because I spend a ton of time covering Gonzaga in Spokane over the years.
Okay.
But I love that coaching staff, and it's most of the same guys now that were there back when I covered the sport, Mark Few, Tommy Lloyd, and they've got a chance to make history to be the first undefeated team for an entire season since Indiana in 75-76. And I have so much fun watching them play. And it's fascinating to me. I don't know if it's bad to compare this to like the U.S. men's soccer story or like what the U.S. men's soccer team wants to aspire to be. But I look at Gonzaga basketball as this team that went from a Cinderella in the 90s to like a mid-major, which is kind of what you would describe the U.S. men's soccer team now as, maybe slightly moving beyond that, to being a powerhouse.
Yeah.
And the team that wins it. And it's not the same thing as trying to do that in the soccer world, but there are some similarities there. Like, how do you go from being a mid-major to being a contender to win the whole thing? And I love how they've gone about doing it. You know, Spokane, Washington is not the most exciting place in the world. And so you're not going to be able to take advantage of recruiting to say, come to Spokane. It's this amazing place. You know, it's not like recruiting to UCLA.
Yeah.
And yet they've done it, and they built this basketball culture there that is really cool.
Yeah. Cool.
Good pick.
I like that.
They look good.
Yeah, they look really good. So how do you turn the US Open Cup into March Madness in the MLS bubble? How do you do that?
Good question.
That's next step.
That'd be
right?
Cool, actually. They
figure something
that'd
out with sick. This US Open.
That'd be cool.
That would be incredible.
Like, for me, I'd like to see MLS teams always have to go on the road in US Open Cup against smaller teams. And we see that in some European countries where, like, I'm pretty sure in Germany, if you're like in the Bundesliga, you have to go on the road for cup games, mm-hmm. at least for a certain period of the tournament. Mm-hmm. I like what's been done from a media perspective, where now you can basically watch almost every US Open Cup game. Like, it might be like one camera from like above, and that might be kind of a terrible production, but like, you can actually see it if you want to. And I'd like to see US soccer get behind it a little bit more and make the prizes, the money prizes bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of history there that.
So much. You can't
fabricate it's history, right? It's older. Isn't it older than the England's FA Cup, I think? Like, it's around that old. Yeah. And so, like, would I like to see somebody, who knows, maybe me doing like a story at some point, either writing or video about the Brooklyn Italians who won like the 1958 US Open Cup? Yeah, sure. I mean, like, I'd like to see more of that, because we have a history of soccer in the United States, none more so than in the US Open Cup. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to see more of that get mainstream, and hopefully that'll happen.
Good answer.
Cool.
All right, we got a couple questions for you. So
real
too
quick
hard.
Though, Grant, if you answer all five of these questions, you can ask us any question, and we'll all have to answer honestly, just so you know.
Okay. I'm an avid listener, so I know how this works.
Okay, there you go. Thank you.
All right. So we'll make this a two-part question. Best soccer city in U.S. By rank: Portland, Seattle, L.A., Kansas City, Atlanta, or St. Louis? There's a lot there. So Portland, Seattle, L.A., Kansas City, Atlanta, St. Louis.
You're going to have to remind me again, because these are a lot of names, but yeah, I will say you realize I'm a Kansas City native. So if I pick a
soccer. You can't pick with your heart. You can't pick with your heart.
If I pick Soccer City USA, for me, Portland.
I
like that pick.
Number one.
And Portland with a picture of Alan Gordon holding the chainsaw up after scoring a goal for the Timbers.
I like that.
And I saw through the turf on that one, by the way. the groundskeeper was not really happy with me. So you're going Portland.
I'm going to go Portland.
Okay, now you got – yep.
And then, you know, like – Seattle and Kansas City are pretty close for me. Next up, like, I'm going to go with Seattle, but not by much. I feel like, you know, what they've been able to achieve soccer, like, it's a little like Atlanta in the sense that soccer feels major league, truly major league in Seattle. And the numbers of people that are required to do that are extraordinarily high. And they did it before Atlanta did. Now I'm going to give Kansas City next just because I'm amazed at how for many years now they've turned a soccer wasteland into a city where everyone wants to go watch soccer on a Saturday night and fill that amazing stadium. And it's not the biggest stadium in the world, but it's a great atmosphere and it's a real soccer culture.
Yeah, that's no joke. I remember the Arrowhead days, and if you would have asked any player which team was going to fold, which franchise, yeah, it would have been Kansas City would have been top
yeah.
three.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that transition is still something very rare, right, of taking an original MLS city and making soccer matter. Because they MLS has been very successful with expansion, but not in taking, like, I'm curious to see if Columbus can get there because they're doing some good things to try and get there. Atlanta, incredible. What they built from scratch in a city that, good job, Dan.
And you don't have to add St. Like, Louis to that. Dan probably put it on there because he lives there. But really,
I actually put it on because I remember playing in a Final Four there, and they claim that they're a soccer city.
I mean, the thing about it is, MLS coming to St. Louis finally is you can make the argument historically that it's the biggest soccer city in America.
Yes, that's their claim to fame, and they run with it. And I mean, to their credit,
there's been some good players.
There's some great players that have come out of town here. And there's also, I think, you know, if you take it into modern terms, they sold 50,000 season tickets in 25 minutes.
Give it 5 years. Right. I think we could be putting that up in the top.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see.
I mean, if you look at the 1950 World Cup team, how many of those guys were from St. Louis? A lot. You know, professional players in that era. But even today, I mean, Josh Sargent, St. Louis. Becky Sauerbrunn, St. Louis.
Tim Ream, St. Louis.
Tim Ream, Taylor Twellman. Like, a lot.
A bunch of guys.
For a city like St. Louis, yeah. That's good.
And as a Kansas City guy, I can't wait until there's a rivalry again between St. Louis and Kansas City, because I grew up hating the St. Louis Steamers of the MISL and like throwing things at Slobo Ilievsky, the goalkeeper for the Steamers.
So did you ever go to the San Diego soccer games back in the day then? Because they were the team in the late 80s, mid 80s.
That was like Steve Jungle, the lord of all indoors, right?
Yeah, they had a ton. They had a, yeah.
You know the name Don Popovic?
I remember that name.
Yeah, the winningest coach here in St. Louis. Yeah.
I always like the put the city or the, you know, the city or state on paper all time. You know, who would have the best all-time team from
I like doing that,
you know,
too.
That city. Yeah. That's pretty fun.
I like comparing hotbeds. Yeah.
All right. Favorite city to watch a game in. I mean, this could be Portland as well, as I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I mean, for me, Buenos Aires, but
in the U.S.
In the U.S. Yeah. Okay. Favorite city to watch a game in. Good one. There's a lot actually now in MLS, which is a good sign. But I would probably say, I mean, for me, going back home to Kansas City and getting barbecue right across the street from the stadium, I can't beat that.
Yeah.
And you can actually get good barbecue in the stadium.
Yeah,
we get it. You're a Kansas City guy. All right. Most overrated U.S. men's national team player of all time.
Easy one. A little layup.
Most overrated.
He said that so casually, like, oh yeah, you'll have no problem answering this one.
Jesus.
There's clearly one that sticks out in Gordo's mind.
Oh Jesus.
I mean, the thing is like, if you're thinking it, a lot of people probably have as well, you know.
I mean, look, if I just did a podcast series on Freddie Adu. So like Freddie didn't produce. And so you could certainly look at it in those terms, in terms of like, if we're talking about rating, he was rated as like basically the next Pelé.
Yeah, that's true.
It's hard to like single out for me anyone else in the U.S. because, you know, I like, it's a little bit like why I like you guys as MLS players. I mean, like, you guys are the backbone of what this league has become, in the same way that so many guys are the backbone of what the U.S. national team has become. So, I mean, yeah, Freddie Adu.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good answer. Yeah. Well done.
You're disappointed by it, I can tell, but that's okay.
I am, dude. I was hoping you wouldn't think of that one. You know, I wanted you to roast somebody else.
Where everyone was like, oh, I thought he was actually pretty good.
Yeah, so you did well there. You did really well there. All right, if you were an MLS player, which team would you never want to play for?
Tough one. Yeah. Or maybe not. Which team would you never want to play for? I feel like if I, like, you guys know the answer to this. You definitely
me and Gordo
played
for a couple of them.
You definitely know the answer to this. You know, I used to do something annually that I called the MLS Ambition Rankings at Sports Illustrated. And I ranked everyone from top to bottom, basically ranking ownership groups about, do they care? And what's tough is that I used to have the New England Revolution at the bottom, but they've actually shown some more ambition in recent years, spending more money on like a practice facility, a bit more on players. It sounds like they're going to finally build a stadium, maybe, in Boston. So I can't include the New England Revolution anymore. And so I'm going to say Colorado Rapids.
ding, ding, ding. He's done it again.
And that's on Stan Kroenke, right? I mean, it's incredible to me that this guy spent so much money on you know, teams over the years in stadiums and things like that. I had an MLS owner tell me a couple of years ago that he had never met Stan Kroenke. And this was a fairly active MLS owner, but that's crazy. If he had never met Stan Kroenke, like, when you say absentee owner, that's kind of the definition.
Yeah.
And so I don't think an MLS owner has to make his MLS job, his day-to-day job. Like, there's some decent MLS owners who haven't done that. There's also some really good MLS owners who do make it their day-to-day job. But I don't think Stan Kroenke could name, how many players on the Rapids do you think Stan Kroenke could name if he saw them?
Zero.
Yeah.
Not Tim's great. Not
yeah, they could use a Sporting KC like revamp in Colorado.
They need a revamp. Yeah. I mean, it's an MLS player graveyard. It's where it's really where players go to die. I mean, I did. All right, so last one, we'll let you off easy here. Who was the worst interview you've ever had? Any sport?
And you can't use answers you've already previously given.
Oh, wow. You know what's funny? I'm trying to think of, like, has anyone ever walked out of an interview with me?
Or maybe just came at you a little bit during the interview and just wasn't having it, anything like
or,
that?
Or, like, oh, man. Has to be in soccer?
No, preferably. No. Anyone.
Yeah, preferably, yeah. Someone,
I mean,
like, we know.
Preferably. Preferably
soccer soup.
Yeah, that's true. I'll find it in soccer here then. So I'm going back in time. I will say, as a lead into this, that one of my golden rules as a soccer writer is if I know I'm going to write something that will piss off somebody who is on my beat, somebody I know I'm going to be interacting with for a while, I learned early on to give them a heads up before it comes out publicly, so that they find out from me and I'm not shying away from it. And then once it comes out and they read it and they're pissed off, I then give them the opportunity to scream at me for 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And in my experience, what I found is that you can then, they can feel like they vented. I don't argue back with them because I've already said my piece. And then you can ask for an interview again. And they'll probably say yes. But they'll at least appreciate that. Now, I'm not into cheap shots, but like I'm going to be critical of people at times. And so I just want to give them that opportunity. And I think too often journalists, especially now, it's a lot easier to hide and to not have to walk into the locker room after you criticize somebody. And so I try to do it that way. And so as a result, like I'm trying to think, like if I don't think I've ever had somebody walk out of an interview. You know, like I never did get my Abel Xavier interview, unfortunately, for the book.
You did. You got it in the bathroom.
That was it.
This is not correct.
I'll let you off easy. Let me just answer. There's been something. So when you went in to interview the Galaxy and Beckham, did you go in with an idea of a book and switch the direction midway? Is that true?
No, but actually Beckham's a great answer for this, because once the book came out, David and I always had a great relationship. I did a big magazine story on him in 2003, sort of introducing him to the US at the height of his powers. I did another cover story on him in 2007 when he joined the Galaxy. And so we got along really well. And then I got the book assignment, agreed to it. And David's people, because he has so many people around him, weren't going to participate one-on-one unless I gave them $1 million. And I wasn't going to do that because we didn't have that money. Everyone else was participating. I bought Alan lunch or something. He was happy.
It's another country thing. They like to get paid for interviews. We don't do that in the US.
Yeah. We don't demand money.
But I mean, like the thing about it was, the original idea for the book was to just do it about his first half season in 2007, but he got hurt. He arrived hurt. And so there was nothing to write about. So we decided to move everything back a year. And so I followed the team for the entirety of 2008. I wanted the team to be either really good or really bad, because it would be interesting either way. I kind of preferred really good, but the team was really bad.
Yeah.
Really bad.
We delivered.
And like terrible. And so all I did was follow the story where it took me. I interviewed people along the way. Landon Donovan had critical things to say about Beckham. All of it was on the record. The tape was always running. Everyone knew. It was funny because at the beginning of every interview I did, most people said, like, is this for Sports Illustrated this week or for your book? And when I said it was for the book, they were willing to say more critical things and let their guard down, even though it was still on the record. It was a really interesting phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And so David did not like the book when it came out in 2009. I don't know if he ever read it. I know he was told it was not maybe flattering to him. And so I remember, and this is probably like the worst interview ever. Like I remember being in a group interview with David Beckham, like around, I think it was the playoffs in 2009, the year the book came out. And like every journalist who asked him a question other than me would get this long, thoughtful answer. And then I would ask a question and Beckett would give like a one word answer.
Good.
And it was so obvious after a while that I sort of found humor in the whole thing. Like when the Galaxy won the title in successive years afterward, after like literally in the post game press conference, he would like stare daggers at me as if like it was, I had said they wouldn't win or something. I don't know. I mean, like, it was just an odd thing. And so finally, last year, after a decade, more than a decade, David and I had a good interaction here in New York. And he owns the team in Miami now. And I think we're probably eventually going to have an interview again. I have nothing against the guy. I wrote a book where I followed a story for 2 years when his team was really bad. So.
Fair enough.
Good. That's good. You've passed the flying colors, Grant.
Feel free. Nice. You can ask us anything.
I mean, this has been fun, guys. I appreciate it. And by the way, I like this turning the tables thing. It's kind of fun. Yeah. I got a question for Alan Gordon.
Talk to me.
What is the best Beckham story you've got that you haven't told?
It's all right. It's just for the book. It's not for.
Jeez, Louise. Yeah, what a jerk. See, I'm not as clever as you. I can't just back my way out of it like you did. He's got me. He's good at this one. He's good at this game. Okay, good. Well, shoot.
We can cut out the dead air, don't worry.
Grant, that's brutal. I'm just thinking I'm getting everybody in trouble here.
Who's gonna hate me the least from this story?
Yeah, exactly. I can't do it. I'm supposed to be doing this, you know.
You're out of the game. You're out of the game.
I know. Yeah, I'm out of the game.
Say whatever you want. Whatever you want.
Yeah, but I could be, get indicting myself.
Yeah.
You know, there was. Did you ever hear about the story where he kicked the ball about 50 yards through a bullseye in Kansas City?
Yes. I'm really making it hard on you, man. I'm sorry.
I thought you were going to be like, well, that never happened.
Yeah, never happened.
Well, it was actually in St. Louis.
Can I plead the fifth?
Hey, well, it's never been done. It's never been done before. It's never been done.
I got a story. Okay, we used to go, they were milking the cow, right? They were milking David for all it was worth. So we were going to Asia preseason, playing a few games, and it was good for us too, because we were getting a cut, right? Mm-hmm. We negotiated with the MLS, and that's when we started getting paid for these exhibition games. So we'd come away with 10 grand on each side, which I was thrilled about. I was doubling my salary for the year. So I was like, yes, I'm in. Okay. And so postseason, we would go to Australia and New Zealand. So we went to New Zealand, and the owner over there was one club in New Zealand playing in the A-League. We played them over there, and he owned this big club. And I think he had a big crush on David. Shocker, right? But I think it was like a more than a crush, if you know what I mean. And so he like revamped his whole club, did the whole thing, flew out models. That was the who knows if that's true or not, but like put on this huge like circus ole in his club. And we're there halfway through the night. He's like, hey, let's get out of here. It's like, too much, right? So we went and we went with David's bodyguards. We jumped, like a few of us, won't name any names, but a few of us like went, and it was just like four of us. So we go to this bar, this like hot bar in New Zealand, which was not that hot. And so we get in and we're like, they usher us back to the VIP room, and it's just packed. It's crowded, and it's just like not very VIP, you know? And, you know, and David kind of leans over. He's like, there's a lot of dudes in here, huh? And I'm like, yeah, tons. And so he like leans over to his bodyguard and he whispers in his ear. Next thing you know, the club managers ushered every dude out of the VIP, and then they ushered all the girls back to the VIP. So there was literally like 60 girls and 4 guys. And it was like, we were all on The Bachelor. It was too much pressure. We had 10 girls to talk to each. And like, I can't live up to that. So, you know, nothing happened that night, obviously. we got out of there, we hightailed it back to the hotel, and all was good, but that's just kind of the kind of power that he had. So, you know, Alan, girls were asking us if their boyfriends could get in. We're like, nah.
We'll let you off the hook, Alan. You did tell this story on the podcast that we had you on. Yeah.
I was
but
drinking.
I needed, yeah, you were drinking, so I wanted to see if you were gonna go a little further this time, but no, that's good. That's good.
Said this one. Sorry, it's still a good
It's still a great story.
It's still a good story.
Fact check.
No, good stuff. Like, yeah. It was always incredible to me. I still remember the first Toronto road trip that you guys were on when Beck and joined the team. And I somehow snuck into the club that the Galaxy was at in the VIP area and just sort of documented the scene that night. And it was absolutely insane.
It was wild.
He couldn't put it in the book.
Yeah. All right.
Well, good stuff, Grant. Thank you, man. Really appreciate you being on. Good luck with everything going forward. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Really appreciate you having me. And thanks for everything you're doing, all of you, for the sport, whether it's playing or broadcasting. Or Alan, man, we got to get you in soccer media.
This is it.
I'd love to.
This is it. That's why we're bringing him on.
Yeah, I would love to.
Good.
Yeah.
All right, guys. All right. Hey, Grant, it really was a pleasure. Thanks for jumping on.
Thank you, Grant.
Really appreciate it, man. Good chatting with you. Good luck with everything.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Thanks. Have a good week.
Take care.
Take care.
That was awesome. Thank you, Grant Wall. That was really cool to hear a lot of the stories and to actually interview a guy that is the one typically doing the interviews. So that was really cool.
The Alan Gordon tribute show from Grant Wall. He's really held on to a liking for Mr. Gordo, hasn't he? That was
you must have gave him some kind of interview for that book.
Dude, some kind of interview, huh? That lunch must have been really something special.
Listen, we have a special bond
of the wet lunch, right?
he's a good dude. He's one of the more intelligent soccer fans out there. I don't blame him for his taking to me, to be honest.
Understandable. You know,
yeah.
Listen, you can't argue with that. He's super intelligent, knows what he's talking about.
He has covered an awful lot, though. 24 years at SI. I mean, that's an incredible run. I'd be interested for any of our listeners to figure out where that ranks in terms of one a specific time at one place. That's a stretch.
Yeah, and it'll be really interesting to see what he does next. I think he has 2 more pieces to write with SI, and then he's kind of going to figure it out. My guess is he might start something himself, so... we'll see where that goes. But anyways, thank you guys for listening. As always, join the Soup Patreon account. We call them the Soup Porters. Very clever of us. Also, follow us on social at The Soccer Soup. We have our website. We got some merch, some videos, some episodes up there. Our website's www.soccersouppodcast.com. That's it, guys. Thanks for listening. Appreciate it. See you guys next week.
Adios.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.